Progressive Radio News Hour with Stephen Ledman, Thursdays at 11 a.m. and weekends at 1 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome to the Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. My guest today is John McMurtry. John has an extraordinary resume. He is an internationally recognized moral and political philosopher. So many other credentials. Let me just mention a couple of his books, and then I want to make a few introductory comments, and then I want to get right to John for his comments. I've read all three of these. I'll mention these three books. They're marvelous books, Unequal Freedoms, The Cancer Stage of Capitalism, and Value Wars. Might I suggest that the protest, well, let me change that word. Might I hope that the protest going on across America, and today there is an international, global protest against the same things that the people across America are protesting. Oh, I'll say something about that in just a moment. The other book that I read of John's, and I strongly recommend them all, Value Wars. Read those books, and then you'll get out in the streets and start protesting. If you're not out there now, and if you're there, then you're not listening to this program live. Well, you can always listen to it archived anytime, which makes it so easy. I joined the Chicago protest last Saturday. I was a little disappointed with the size, a few hundred people. There was no facility set up for people to speak either by a microphone or a megaphone. I learned that they have regular assemblies. I spoke to a number of people one-on-one and some in very small groups. I told them what I do. I told them about my new book about how Wall Street fleeces America. I asked if I could be invited to an assembly to be able to speak to it, and they said that they would. I have not gotten a contact yet. They have my name. They have my email address. They have my phone number. I sure hope they'll invite me down. I just got an email this morning through another person about a Chicago teach-in connected to the street protesters. And just before airtime, one of the people involved emailed me, asked me to please call when my program is over. Well, I'll do a little bit after that, because right after this program I have an interview on my book. Oh, I had a bonanza at the end of last week, Thursday, Friday. I had, if my count is right, I had four people contact me about interviewing me on the book. So I'm very delighted to do that, and I'll take all comers if they want to discuss this. The issue really isn't the book. The issue is what's going on in the streets and the reasons. And I say it in a word. John says it exactly. John is my teacher on so much of this. But the real core issue is the power of money in private hands to make more of it at our expense. You're going to hear that over and over again on this program, and you'll hear it from John. And this is completely illegal in America. The Constitution does not say that Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan have the power of money. It says the people have the power of money. Well, we the people want to get it back, and I'm not certain the people on the street understand that. They have a laundry list of important grievances. They're wonderful things that need to be redressed, but they're problems, and I haven't seen too much talked about on websites about solutions. So it's important to name the problems, and it's important to name solutions. The first solution is getting the cancer out. The cancer is money, power, and private hands. Accomplish that, and everything else is possible. Don't accomplish that. It's going to be a long, cold road ahead. I'm not certain what's going to get done other than minor things. And there are strong dark forces trying to co-opt this movement across the country. It's in hundreds of cities, over 1,000 from numbers I've seen. I've seen numbers as high as 1,400. If this thing keeps growing, and I hope it will, so far it has, we might see multiple protests going on in cities. Chicago, where I live, my goodness, just staying in metropolitan Chicago from the far north side to the far south side, it's a long, long way. I'm not certain how many people up north will go way down south. So why not have a north and a south side protest? Well, they're downtown at the Federal Reserve Building, the Chicago Merck Exchange, the Midwest Stock Exchange. Well, that's a great central location. So how about three protests? Way up north, including the northern suburbs, way down south, including the southern suburbs, maybe have one on the western side of Chicago, get in the western suburbs, and then have a core one downtown. Oh, that ought to bring out many thousands of people, and they should be. If they just brought out the people who need jobs, been looking, can't find them, I just can't imagine how many people would be turning out in Chicago. But there are plenty of people with jobs who don't have good ones. Instead of better paying full-time, good benefit jobs, they have part-time temp jobs with few or no benefits. That's been the transition of America from when I finished school in 1960 and went to work to today. It's a whole different world. John, I welcome you, and I look forward to your comments. They mean so much to me, and I know to listeners.
Well, it's good to be back, Steve, again. And you're right. Quite a bit's happened, hasn't it, since we were talking last? This whole Wall Street occupation, I think it's really quite important that it stays in Wall Street. The public light on these things is what has been completely lacking. I just have been writing a review, and it just pops out of my mind of what goes on behind the scenes. And what is most important here is that we have people out finally being seen by the media. Only when it went international, by the way, did the U.S. media pay any attention. It had to go international first, and that's also true of Canada. Before it went international, wasn't any attention paid to it except to badmouth them, insult them, calumny, just a continuous calumny of insults upon people who do it. Now that it's in the light, this coming into the light is the key. I mean, this is a state that has, you're going to be interviewing soon Andrew Kolin on state power and democracy. Have you done that interview yet?
It's coming up.
But in any case, one of the cases that he describes is that just before the war criminal bombing of Iraq in 2002, where war crime was left undone, these three nuns had protested against it. They were arrested, handcuffed, left on the ground for 3 hours, and then jailed for 7 months before trial, and their charge was sabotage and obstruction of justice. And this was all done under the Patriot Act. The thing about the U.S. is it is, you know, the argument is that it is a police state, and it's a very persuasive argument. It's done by law. It's not that they go outside the law. A lot of laws are violated, as we know, but a lot of it's just done by the laws. In this case, it was under the Patriot Act after the 9/11 turning point towards the 9/11 wars, a constructed event. And they were identifying a supreme crime, trying to do, and what they did was paint blood on missile silos. That was the nature of their offense, painting blood on missile silos. And because no one was there to watch, because there was no eyes there, because there was a general panic had been produced with the through the Patriot Act, which of course had been written before 9/11 in this constructed event, there was just no light of publicity on what was happening. And so that sort of monstrous thing, and then of course it continued with eventually, they were very right about the blood, eventually 500,000 children lost their lives from that saturation bombing of the public infrastructures, the water supplies, electricity, and so forth, of Baghdad and elsewhere. So what's, I think, quite crucial in the Wall Street occupation is the public visibility of this. It's finally hit. It's finally hit after, as we say, the media had ignored it and insulted it, and of course the police had waded into it with long truncheons, beating people badly. But now it's in the light. And so I think that's so, so crucial that it has staying power inside the light. And what is the problem now, as you've already identified, is that we don't really have any policy. And the same thing, you remember we talked about this when there was the uprisings in Egypt and Cairo and so forth. We were pointing out that there was really just no policy formation. It seemed to be really no idea of an alternative. And this seems to be also afflicting this protest. And that's, of course, being said by all the corporate media, is to say, well, they don't know what they're doing. They're, you know, ragtag bunch. They have no ideas, et cetera, of invalidating them. And there's a very obvious idea, and you've pressed it very hard in your in your book, How Wall Street Fleeces America, Privatized Banking, Government Collusion, and Class War. The banking system, the money system, the money, private money sequencing system, as you've already said, is, as I analyze now, 12 years ago, I guess it's actually 15 years ago, since that diagnosis of the cancer stage of capitalism first came out in a public health issue of social justice in California, a journal there. It's been a long, long time, and all we've seen is confirmation of the diagnosis. And it really is, and I've said it often enough, not to repeat it, but, you know, it's sequencing money into more money without producing anything for private money owners with no limit whatsoever until we get the situation we have now, where the whole of the planet Earth is being taken apart to continue this money sequencing, humorously called growth, in private hands more and more and more at the top, and then whenever it loses, then the public ends up paying its future taxes, and the whole public sector ends up paying for it. It's just the most monstrous structure of occurrence that's continued over a long time. I'd say in cost terms, it probably exceeds the Nazis. And it just goes on and on and on, and finally we have a spotlight on it. And by the way, it's not just the possibly 1,400 cities and towns of America, whatever it is, it seems to have been growing very rapidly. It's spread into Canada too. There's demonstrations going on in Canada, in Toronto, in Vancouver, in Edmonton, even in little Guelph, which is a small city. There's going to be protests of this sort. And the key thing, which you've really more than perhaps anyone I know in the United States, there are a couple of people who've just pressed this, anybody who really knows anything knows this, it's got to be a public banking system. We have to. The failure of this system is so extraordinary, so spectacular, so extreme, so ruinous, that this is an idea, you know, whose time has come, and in fact it's a necessity. And I wish, you know, people in these occupations of the Wall Street and so forth would start to point out the obvious, the no-brainer. We need a public banking system. And once you get that public banking system, then money is loaned in accordance with human needs. And it's lent in accordance with human needs, both to individuals, and it's lent to governments. Governments, as you know, are just basically backing up the bank's loans of the money the government creates for them to borrow from the banks at compound interest. It's just, it's so absurd and obscene, this whole process. And so the first thing that happens with public bank formation, a public bank of the United States of America, the first thing that happens is governments. That's where government loans come from. In fact, that's where all the money's coming from anyway, as we've seen. Only we're paying compound interest and bailouts and everything else to private banks that go on cancer invading the world. So the public bank of the United States lends to governments, first of all. Well, then, as you've also pointed out in your book, that makes everything affordable, because you're not paying compound interest rates on what occurs. You're investing in what is needed inside the society, and as you've also pointed out, and I think quite wisely, that the thing that people most need, I mean, originally when this whole collapse happened, I was saying, well, since it's happened over housing, that's where the public banking takes over to begin with, is all home loans are made through a public body at low interest rates in accordance with need and ability of people to repay so that you don't hollow out the public sector as the private banks do, don't hollow out their resources to continue doing this job. But I think now it's more and more clear that it's not just homes, it's jobs. And that's really where a public bank would be most important. And I think that organizing principle you implied earlier on in this program, saying, I wish all the people who require jobs and are willing to do jobs and really have something to offer were really a major part of these demonstrations. If you, as you say, if they came out, if only they came out, these demonstrations would be huge, because we have a real rate of unemployment in the United States of over 20%. You know, all the people who aren't looking for, you know, that have stopped registering for looking for work and so forth, they're still unemployed. That is able-bodied people who are willing to work that are unable to work because of the cancer stage of capitalism. This public bank would invest in public employment for things that need to be done, and lots needs to be done. You need to, the one of the biggest investments they could make would be what's been a long-term concern in the States, in fact, the leading cause of bankruptcy, is a public health program. That's where the investments would go. That's what a public bank, first of all, would be able to do, is that we invest in a public health program that actually serves the health of the people instead of being just another cancer sequencing private enterprise, you know, not an enterprise, health maintenance organizations and so forth, with by far the leading cost per capita in the world, with 49 or 50 million people without any insurance at all, another 25 million people underinsured, and the biggest cause of death is inside their systems. I mean, this is the first, well, not the first place, but obviously one of these running sores, these tumors that have grown up in the United States around health care, as well as around employment, as well around homes, are the things that the public bank would invest in. And so you could go, I mean, public libraries, of course, and then, of course, the infrastructure that are falling down, bridges, roads, and so forth. The public arts, which was very big. Roosevelt actually changed the course of artistic culture and history in the States by making large amounts of money available through, again, a public banking system, so to speak, though it was government investment in this case, in the arts. So there's no end of places that this can go that are running sores and tumors of the United States social fabric that a public bank would solve. Its time has come.
John, its time has come. In two interviews on my book I've already had, and I've got more coming up, I was asked about quantitative easing. Quantitative easing gets its ears boxed, and it should, the way it's been used. Quantitative easing is simply money creation, and the issue isn't the fact that it's done, it's what it's used for.
Yes.
If it goes productively into the economy to create growth, not to bankers, to pay big bonuses and salaries, to speculate, to buy up competitors cheap, that's the bad
part.
Not
to loan money.
That's when quantitative easing is cancerous. But if it goes into the economy, it's wonderful, and that's exactly what's happened in the past twice in America. In colonial America, John, under Lincoln, when he simply told the bankers, in diplomatic language, I'm sure, go to hell, when they wanted to charge him 36% interest to finance the Civil War, he created greenbacks, government-created money that they paid no interest on.
Right.
Why in hell should the government pay interest on its own money?
I mean,
it does. It pays it to bankers. That is crazy.
And it's so little known. I mean, I was going to the local market today, Saturday, and just sort of testing out that if anybody had heard of the notion of a public bank, you know, people who run the stores as well as colleagues at the university and so forth, and nobody's heard of it. I don't really quite know how successful, you know, what have been the mechanisms of success in keeping this possibility a complete no-no, a complete taboo subject so that nobody knows about it. Even though even though it's worked, as you say, not in colonial script times and also in Lincoln's time, and as your book also identifies and spells out about North Dakota, where we have a very successful public banking system that's been going there for, I guess, 30, 40 years.
Almost 100 years, 1990.
Yeah, 100 years. And this has worked. They've got the lowest unemployment rate. They've got no deficits. You know, everything is, even in this time of crisis, everything in government, you know, because of the public bank, everything is okay. That is how complete its resolution can be inside society. Once, as you point out, once it goes to human life needs, and human life needs, both collective and individual, are that, you know, anything without which life capacities are reduced. That's all you can lend money for. Then that completely reverses. Now all you can lend money for is to get more money into private hands, to turn it into more money into private hands without producing anything for anyone, but in fact more and more taking the means of life and the means for producing the means of life away from people. So that's why, you know, it has no committed function to the life host whatsoever, behaves in all the hallmark characteristics of a cancer. It is a cancer. And we have it at the social level of life organization. And the banking, the public banking resolution, and again, don't want to sound repetitive, but it's once you, the ideas just cascade out of how important this is on every level of organic and social as well as ecological life organization, because that's the only way you can get investment circuits going that serve life rather than money cancer.
Oh, absolutely, John. Going back, my God, in the 1950s, organized labor had reached its peak back then. Private organized labor was about 35% of the workforce. Now it's down to 7%. But back in those days, Detroit was the industrial hub of America, along with Pittsburgh. I worked in Pittsburgh in the 1960s, early 1960s, and again later in the 1960s. Pittsburgh was a booming industrial town. It isn't anymore. Detroit is like Greece. Detroit is a zombie. Unemployment.
Well, it's worse than Greece. It's like a, you know, it's a third world society.
John. It costs, but it's crazy. Well, a country like Greece, and it looks like more countries in Europe are heading for Greek status. Effectively, the destructive rules are wreck the economies to save the banks. The most important thing is make sure the bankers get paid. Don't worry about people needs. Don't worry about the economy. And that's exactly what happens. So Greece
is a zombie. They haven't gotten onto it in Europe. I mean, this is what's happened all the time. This is being headlined as bailing out Greece, bailing out Portugal, bailing out Spain, et cetera, et cetera. It's only bailing out banks.
And John, you want to know the craziest thing
you
ever heard of?
You guys don't know how to do the job, and we're going to do it into public investment. The idea is taboo to mention. It's incredible it hasn't come up, even amongst progressive people in Europe and Britain. It's the only time it's been coming up, really, that I've observed around the world right now is the United States and Canada. I mean, we've been working on this. A group called Economic and Monetary Reform has been working on this for 40 years. You know, there have been people who know, and you know, banking very well and so forth, and there is some. There is, just reflecting now, there is some of this going on in Britain as well as Australia and New Zealand. So there's a lot of well-informed people who know about it, but you'll notice in the headlines it's never said bailing out banks, not states or peoples. It's always bailing out the banks. And you know that, I think I sent that article to you by Jim Stanford that was in the Globe and Mail, which is our equivalent to the Wall Street Journal. And he's a person I know, and I've had been on a public platform before and mentioned this. You know, the key is the public creation and of credit, and that we don't leave that to private hands. We recover it from our constitutional you know, our constitutional articles, as you well know, and Canada, the same thing. In fact, we have a, you know, we have a Government of Canada Bank. I shouldn't say a Government of Canada Bank. It's called the Bank of Canada. It is a public bank, and it is empowered to lend up to 35% of all the provincial spending, 25% of all the municipal spending, and I think it's 60% of all federal spending. This Bank of Canada can do. It's right in the Bank of Canada Act, which was passed in the 1930s. They never use it. Nobody knows about it. Again, you have this silence, this institutionalized silence on the idea. It's already ready and happening. So this fellow, who's an economist for the United Canadian Auto Workers, this is their chief economist. He's a very intelligent man. He'd always resisted that people just don't want to touch this public banking. Well, finally, he said there should be a public presence in the relationship of debt and credit. And that's all he said. Well, he was, I don't know whether you know this, but he was attacked. He was attacked inside, you know, they have these online things of the Globe and Mail, like the New York Times or elsewhere, online letters and so forth that are very carefully vetted. And all the letters were denouncing him for being a socialist, for being out of date, for being, you know, obviously inspired by the moneyed interest, the money party, as it's been long called. And I wrote an article or a letter in to say how important his insight was. Finally, the Globe and Mail was telling the truth, I said, that it wasn't these countries that were being bailed out. It was the private banks who were being bailed out, and that there should be a public presence in the credit-debt relationship. They didn't publish my, even though it was only online. Now I'm a taboo there because I used to write a lot for them in print, but also what they're not supposed to do, they just kept it out, just wouldn't print it. All they would print was attacks on the man for even suggesting it. So that's the problem we're up against. People have been so frightened into silence in this, even if they know it, but almost nobody knows it. Finally, we have a public light on things. Finally, we have people on the ground who are standing up saying something has gone terribly wrong. We must do something. And we have the resolution. So I really think it's a connection that is right, very crucial right now. And in fact, I really wonder whether you shouldn't. You have several chapters in your book, on why public banking works, where it's worked, and so forth. And it's already in very readable form. Whether there shouldn't be some sort of a handout of your a couple of pages of to let people know there is a solution.
Oh, that's a wonderful idea. That really is a wonderful idea. John, you know, you talk about you being banished and they won't print what you write in the Globe and Mail.
The corporate media,
in the corporate media overall.
Corporate media,
Paul Craig Roberts comes on this program every now and then when he's available. Former Assistant Treasury Secretary under Ronald Reagan, former Associate Editor of the Wall Street Journal. They will not publish what he writes now because he's a severe critic of the system. He writes marvelous stuff. We talk about it on this program. Same kind of discussions that we're having now. He doesn't talk about public banking, John. But
well, that's what I wondered. I haven't seen anything about public banking from him, and that's the key.
No, he hasn't gone there, but he sure takes on other important issues.
Yeah, he'll take on 9/11.
I mean, the banker bailouts,
a lot of things. And it's interesting because he was very much a sort of a libertarian reactionary about, you know, marketize everything when he was with Reagan. And so he's a guy who sort of is a harbinger of what is coming, of people who are inside the system who finally recognize something has gone wrong. And once the mask is off, once the you know, basically the blinkers are off, then they can finally see, and then they see through. But even then, you see, public banking is something he's afraid to mention.
Well, maybe he'll get to that one day, John. Let's take a quick break, and then we'll come back and continue this.
Right.
On with John McMurtry. John, you know, some old sayings, simple ones, make so much sense. Well, one just popped into my mind. The proof of the pudding is in the eating. If an idea works, why not stick with it? And if an idea has proved repeatedly, every time it's been tried, it does not work. So, on the issue of banking, every time banking power, money power, not banking power, money power has been put on, in private hands, it fails because these greedy people, they just want to use all the money they can get their grubby paws on to make more. They don't care about the economy. They don't care about the damage they do. But every time money power has been in public hands, public banking, a public utility, it works. In colonial America, under Lincoln, in North Dakota, in 2008, the height of the U.S. financial crisis, the global financial crisis, North Dakota had 3% unemployment, and it had the highest budget surplus in the state's history. Instead of raising taxes and laying people off and finding other ways to cut expenses, they rebated some of the surplus to residents of North Dakota. Well, no other state came in. Well, no other state did that, and no other state came close to doing as well as North Dakota. And it isn't an issue of size. The critics say, well, you know, North Dakota's a tiny state. You know, it's not like New York or California. Well, it is, because the resources, the financial resources they have are proportional. California must have 50 times the population of North Dakota. They have 50 times the resources. If they put those resources into a public bank, I heard Ellen Brown say this on this program, they would have something like $120 billion before fractional reserve banking multiplied it. Well, the state's deficit, I haven't checked it lately, but I can remember at one time I saw numbers $20 billion, somewhere around that. $20 billion? Pocket change if you get $120 billion to play with. They could wipe out the deficit with one click on a computer keyboard and have $100 billion left over to put into productive investment to grow the state, grow jobs, get rid of unemployment, and turn California into a model the way the rest of the state should be done.
Has anybody brought it up in California that you know of?
Oh, they had a bill that passed their legislature. Not the former public bank, John, but the former committee to study it.
Yeah. Well, it's better than the silence. And
it died, John. It died. Governor Jerry Brown refused to sign it.
Oh,
well, somebody needs to go to Sacramento and yank him out of the Capitol building and get somebody in there who will sign it. Legislature override him.
Well, you know, it's been a long... I mean, you remember what Jefferson said about banking institutions are more dangerous to our liberty than standing armies. Already they've raised up a moneyed aristocracy that has set the government at defiance. The money and credit issuing power should be taken from the banks and restored to the people to whom it properly belongs. Way back at the beginning. And that has been silenced. So it was a colonial script. Then it was the guy who wrote the American Constitution itself who's saying this. And then we know of Lincoln, and of course counter-legislation all the way through. And then we know Roosevelt moving in that direction, as you say, every time it's worked. But the problem is we have I mean, the states basically has a police state repression of anybody who suggests these alternatives. And this is why it's so important that this thing is broken out into the open so that the words at least can be finally mouthed. You know, from the beginning, from the 20th century, we can see the Sedition and Alien and Espionage Acts of the, you know, early parts of the century. They were all to stop anybody having alternative thinking and not withdrawn. Then the Internal Security Act of 1950, the Smith Act, and then McCarthy's House American Un-American Activities Committee, and so on. And all of that was to stop anybody coming in with the idea of public installations, and public banking would be the key. Though interestingly enough, while they were calling anyone with alternative ideas communists and so forth, interestingly enough, it isn't really a communist idea, although Marx brings in a national public bank, but he just sees it as an intermediary thing. He doesn't anticipate the cancer stage of capitalism, because in his day, capital was productive. You had to sell something that people wanted and are willing to pay a price before you could make a profit. And he didn't recognize that the money sequence can skip the middle term and just go straight on to making money, 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 money. He thought, well, that'll bring crisis and that'll straighten things out. You know, the collapse of the system will straighten it out, so you can't keep on investing money this way because it has no returns. He didn't realize the thing could turn into a cancer. So it isn't, it's an idea whose time has come in a way, but doesn't come from the usual suspects, so to speak. It's just, you know, I've long wanted to, and do now describe myself when people say, well, this is left wing or that's right wing. It's just, no, it's deep center. That we're deep centrists. And we go to the fundamentals. And the fundamentals are, in an economy, a market-style economy, an exchange economy, the fundamentals are who creates the issues, the debt, in the society, and the credit. That's the fundamental issue. That's going down to the ground. And then you're also deep center when you say, well, all we really should be investing in, if we have a public bank, all it should be investing in is public sector activities through loaning the money at low interest and in accordance with productivity for life needs, direct or indirect life needs. And on the private level, that's, you know, you lend it for people's homes, you lend it for people's farms, you let, you know, anything that's creating a means of life for others or oneself and for others is invested in. And we've just had this is the deep center. This isn't extreme left. This isn't right. This is deep centrist thought, where you actually go down to the life ground, what its requirements are, and to develop tools of civilization we have to meet them, and to develop even further need objects, like as we have with computers and books and so forth. And the more you think about it, you know, the more flamingly obvious it is as a resolution, and not only flamingly obvious in a theoretical sense, but has been, as you said, tried and worked. And the other has been tried again and again, and in Einstein's sense of insanity, and expecting a better result, and has failed ever more terribly, to now it's the final failure. So we really get to a no-brainer. And then at that point, then you really realize, there's been a crushing of these alternatives. It isn't just because people are stupid and we're smart. It's there's been a crushing of the ideas. And I just, one of the things I wanted to mention today was Libya. Just how much, now there's a place that did whatever you think of Gaddafi, it did understand, it had a public banking system, and it had guaranteed subsistence, and it had free higher education, and free healthcare, and all kinds of other things. And that's the biggest danger. That was the biggest danger in Iraq, that was the biggest danger in Nicaragua, all the places they've committed war crimes against. That was the biggest danger in Yugoslavia, is that you actually have a system that works, that is publicly based, so the society as a whole. And that would mean a public banking system. It doesn't mean that people, that they don't have a private use of their homes or any of the other crap that is always projected onto it. These, whatever form it took, and it didn't need to take a communist form, or even, it just had to be anywhere where you have a public sector development of meeting people's needs and planning to do so, rather than the money coming in from outside and going out at a faster rate to foreign investors who have absolutely nothing in mind other than to maximize their revenues in the fastest way possible. They had worked up an alternative, and so any place where you have an alternative is that's where they end up bombing you. And so I just want to, before Libya disappears into the dark hole of history with the continuous bombing and war crime that seems not to even be paid attention to. Every kind of war crime is going on there on behalf of an orchestrated civil war that they have put the people in power in order to take their oil and in order to take their actually considerable wealth that was being held in foreign banks and so forth, which is public wealth. You notice Gaddafi didn't escape with huge amounts of money. And they've taken $500 billion. I mean, it's unbelievable, the rate that has occurred of Libya. But before it goes out, and let's, you know, perhaps it still has a chance, but it seems pretty, you know, when you have the whole of NATO ganging up on you one-sidedly, as well as the ragtag bunch that you put in as hirelings, it's pretty hard to stand up against NATO. Just for the record, Libya had the highest living standards in Africa. Libya had an index, a human development, you know, that's the UN count, an HDI, human development index. It had a higher index rate than anybody in Africa. It had, including, if you include Saudi Arabia, a very wealthy oil country, too, higher than Saudi Arabia. It had all, as I mentioned, had all its subsistence guaranteed. It had free health care. Its age expectancy was, again, higher than any other African country, higher than Saudi Arabia. It's 74.5 years. It had made significant progress in gender equality, according to the UN, again. That's their those words from the Human Development the development UNESCO outfit. But what it did, you see, what really occurs, Gaddafi's crimes and so forth are largely projections, but the real crime for the NATO and why they bombed him is that he refused to join the, not only did he have a social infrastructure that was publicly directed and owned, but he refused to join the Africa Command, AFRICOM, and he was the only country that refused in Africa, and that war. Well, that's a, you know, once you do that with the U.S., then you're up for bombing. It also had, this was really quite important, and nobody's mentioned it. It had connected the whole of, it had made the largest investment in connecting the whole of the African continent by telephone and television and radio and, you know, just an electronic connection system. Including telemedicine and so forth. It had done all this and it was required to have $400 million for Africa to do it by itself, and Libya put up $300 million of that $400 million. In the prior time, and you can see how this would offend telecommunications, they'd want them out of there. They had collaborating with the IMF, who they were charging a $500 million per year service fee where they own nothing just to have this electronic stuff now that they have for free for this one big investment that the Libyans put the most money, three quarters of the money in, and included a communications satellite. And, of course, it had central public ownership of its central bank, which is necessary for any civilized society. And Canada, I'll go on to mention, Canada does have one. We have one, and it was put in the 30s, and it has these rights to loan and so forth, obligations to loan. It's just that it's been stifled by the Money Party. And then one of the worst things he did was... is just refuse the International Monetary Fund, the IMF, from any action inside Africa. Anything it could do to replace the IMF, it did. And then at the same time, and this is horror of horrors in a way for Europe and the U.S., it started to partner in many billions of dollars with China in its development contracts. So here Libya had formed a public banking, you know, and had all these things, the basic needs of people being met and so forth, and that has been destroyed. And then, of course, it's the usual thing we've talked about before. You just demonize the leader, and go on and on and on, and, you know, what's in logic called an ad hominem fallacy. You just can't talk about anything else but the ad hominem to the person it means literally, and have managed to keep everybody's eyes off the ball, so to speak, the deep center, so to speak, the actual human life needs of a society and its development. They've succeeded in doing it. I mean, I only know this because, you know, these things come across in your research. You probably have seen this information too.
I wrote about it, John.
It's unheard of.
I wrote so much on Libya, I'm still doing it. Indeed, I wrote about this, these wonderful social benefits. And of course, Libya didn't need to the IMF or the other international lending agencies, because with a public bank, it created all the money that is needed.
Yeah.
It could be its own IMF, making low interest rate loans, not predatory loans, to other nations. So Libya under Gaddafi committed the sin of success outside of the predatory Western model. Now that is the ultimate sin in the eyes of Washington and London and Paris and these parasites that want it all for themselves. And by the way, John, that war is still raging, and NATO, with all the firepower they have thrown at Libyans, it'll be 7 months on the 19th of this month, in just a few days. They have not beaten the Libyan people yet by a long shot, and the forces on the ground, the battles go back and forth. But the rebels, with all the firepower given them by NATO, there are lots of battles where they're getting their ears pinned back, including in Tripoli.
Special forces too, Steve. There's a lot of special forces, British, American, and French special forces in there.
Oh, indeed, absolutely. And from other countries, too. Qatar has them in there.
Yeah.
There were rumors that Egypt had them in there. You know, I mean, they hide them. They're there.
Yeah.
And they don't walk in there wearing U.S. uniforms or U.K. uniforms. I don't know how they come in.
I heard guys with British accents speaking to the press at CBC about the liberation.
And they don't speak Arabic. Anybody with a strange accent who doesn't speak Arabic, you know darn well who they represent. They certainly don't represent Libya. But the Libyans are holding their own, even though they are literally being put through hell. I did a little calculation, John. Nobody knows how many people have been killed, but the numbers are mounting, dozens, hundreds every single day. And I threw a number out some weeks back, 100,000. And I said America has 50 times the population of Libya. If an equivalent catastrophe struck America, we'd be talking about 5 million dead. Maybe 25 million wounded, because the multiples wounded for everyone killed, and many, many more grieving family members. This would be an unprecedented calamity in U.S. history, and it never even gets a blip in the major media. Not a blip.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the media are, the corporate media are structures of cover-up. That is their nature. And you think of it applying in every single level. There are structures of cover-up, and they'll just digress to something else, you know, some personality conflict or whatever permits and enables a complete cover-up of the relevant and deep, what I'll call again, the deep center facts. Just think of anything. Whatever the issue is, they're a structure of cover-up, their very nature. We just saw the example when I was giving of the Globe and Mail, that example about public banking. Of course, that's everywhere. there. Or you'll find the same thing about Libya. They're just a structure of cover-up. None of these facts were ever known. It just became a personality war, you know, where they demonize somebody and then you do anything, whatever, to the society that he's a member, that he's the head of, and nobody notices. And in fact, they not only they don't notice it, they resent you exposing it. And of course, if you try to say it inside the corporate media, they won't report it. Before the Iraq war, I don't know whether I've mentioned this, I, you know, was aware of war crimes under international law and what their precise nature was, and the supreme crime of invading another country and not in self-defense, the crime of all crimes, as it's called, under law, in law, in the original Nuremberg Charter. I just wrote to all the newspapers, and I've been published in many of my correspondences, you know, innumerable newspapers, and just wrote them, just saying a very simple paragraph, saying that this is a war crime. What you're planning to do, and what they're planning to do now, is a planning and preparation, and just cited the international law on it as supreme crime. No one published it. No one. So that's how far the structure of cover-up goes. Right, and including, you know, progressive journals like the, but as long as they have advertising, they, you know, they're a corporate vehicle. The Guardian, it wouldn't publish it. I sent it in various forms and so forth. I put it in under other names thinking, I think they must, surely they can't, all of them, they can't just keep selecting this out, and it is so totally irrelevant to what's about to occur.
John, I'll tell you what they do publish. I will have another Libyan article maybe in a couple of 3 days, but this will be the article at the beginning. An October 11th press conference, we only have a couple of minutes and I want to give most of it to you. NATO had an October 11th press conference, and in it it said, quote, "We did the right thing. We saved countless lives." This is a quote. "We saved countless lives. We did it the right way, fast, 7 months and counting. With flexibility.
Surgical strikes.
Oh, surgical strikes. And we did it for the right reasons, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera."
And the corporate media will just report that, period.
Oh, exactly. And nothing countermanding that. I mean, everything I just quoted is a bald-faced lie, obviously.
Yeah. Yeah.
John, we got about 3 or 4 minutes. Let me let you take it all. And what are the final thoughts that you have?
Well, you know, I just think on this Wall Street thing, and I was going to speak more about the background that we have to this. We have a criminal organization that's running the world really now, just as we almost had it with the Nazis. And the Nazis, indeed, all their information was transferred to the United States under the Fort Treaty and NATO under the Fort Hunt Treaty Act and the death squad methods and so forth. And we went for 25 years or so where, you know, there was alternatives available. There was various forms of socialism and social democracy and mixed economies and Scandinavian, so, you know, all these different alternatives of possibility. And there was a chance of growing an alternative and developing an alternative with this. And that was why the whole system went in with Reagan, especially, is just to annihilate. That was the structure of meaning throughout. And you just look at all the facts. Annihilate any other alternative and call it free market and democracy, free market and democracy. And what we've had for the last 30 years now is an annihilation of any alternative. The language of and they're saying it still now, there's no choice, there's no alternative. That's what they're saying about our finance minister, saying about bailing out the banks. And now we have the people out in the streets saying, you have to have an alternative. This society is in breakdown stage. We don't have jobs. We don't have sufficient, you know, et cetera, et cetera. All the things that the economy is supposed to do, they failed at doing. And so I think we're breaking, it's breaking out into the open in a way that we haven't seen since the 60s, and in a way it's better than the 60s because it's more informed, the understanding. The real shortfall at this moment is that we do not have the people on the street knowing the technically and strategically and deep center alternative is already there, and that's what they must insist on. That's because we now there's a light on this, and there hasn't been a light. We've been talking about all the repression and gagging and killing. There's a light on it, and they would like to do all that, but they can't do it. They just failed trying to do it. And so while the light's on, we must declare.
We sure must, John. This really is a great moment. This is the 60s. As important as it was to focus on civil rights and then later ending the Vietnam War, crucial issues, now it's the whole package. I've seen the laundry list of complaints, and you've got people in Washington that are really focusing on all the major issues. I mean, these people, they can't quit. We have to go for the brass ring. Literally, the future of you can call it 99% or whatever percentage you want.
Yeah.
It's the great majority of people in this country and around the world.
And around the world. This is global.
This is global. This is absolutely global. And with a globalized world, we're all in this game together. And we all have to fight this thing to the bitter end. And know what's important to get. And literally, don't compromise. Go for what's right. Expunge what's wrong. And there's nothing in between. And
no more silencing.
John, I many thanks for a terrific hour. I shot you an email and getting you back real soon. I look forward to the next time.
And I as well, Steve. Let's hope the whole world is moving the way we hope.
I hope they're listening, John. I really hope they're listening. I'm ready to go out and talk to anybody if they'll listen to me.
Well, I think that idea of distributing, you know, the alternative, the public bank alternative is the key to success.
Absolutely. We're out of time. I'll say goodbye and just ask listeners. Come on back tomorrow at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. We'll keep doing this. Make this a regular habit.